Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways. Alarm, alarm. Welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk with me, Al Murray, and James Holland. James Holland sniffling in Winchester, in Wiltshire there. How are you, Jim?
Yeah, I'm all right. Yes, I am okay. It's one of those sort of winter colds that's been going around. Everyone seems to have had it. But it seems to last sort of 2 weeks. It's just really boring. Yeah, I feel I'm on the way out. Anyway, how are you?
You're on the way out?
I mean on the way out of the end of the cold.
God, yeah. Blimey. Yeah, I thought you were dropping some quite heavy heavy news there. Yeah. Carry on without me.
Contemplating imminent death, yeah.
I've written this letter for Rachel.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, for my loved ones. There's actually even one for you, Al. I'm going to leave you my model collection, my uniforms, my flying helmets.
I have to stay
and
slim.
You can have that as well. I might leave that one for Joey, actually.
Yeah, the one with FAP on.
Right. Yeah.
Right, so tickets to We Have Ways Festival went on general sale on Friday. The weekend of the 18th to 21st of July, isn't it? Is that right? Yes. Next year, at Black Pit Brewery, so the same place as last year. We look forward to seeing you all there. We've talked invasion stripes all round. We're already having a good proper think about what the program is going to be and how we fit everything in, basically. That's yet again the problem.
That will be the challenge. The
tickets, like I say, at wehavewaysfest.co.uk are on sale. We don't like to do the hard sell on here, so go have a look at the site. There's a VIP ticket with some meet and greet sort of stuff. Under 16s are free, so we're trying to be a bit more family friendly this year. And we hope to see you all there.
It is going to be really, really fun.
Yeah. Yeah,
it is going to be bigger and better. And
if you've not been, it's basically a whole weekend of us wanging on about the war.
So how are you getting on then? So you're currently in a studio reading Robert Hutton's book, aren't you?
On Friday, I got this USB stick which has all of every airborne unit possible's war diaries. Like,
fantastic! How did you get that?
Oh, well, you've got to know the right people, Jim. And be prepared to cross their palms with silver, basically. But it's everything. It's literally everything. Photocopies, you know, or scans of absolutely everything. Not just First Airborne Division, everybody. Everybody faintly airborne, SAS, everything. Right? So and there's the Pegasus Archive, which is where I got it from Mike, who runs that. And There are transcriptions of the war diaries on there, but the actual documents—it's very interesting. Some of it is sort of slightly different, and you start looking around in the type documents and looking for what's being said and all this sort of stuff. It's very interesting. The other thing is I thought, well, let's have a look at. So I'm looking at signals at the moment. Of course, famously, it's the radios are supposedly the big problem.
Yeah, don't work. They're no good.
Yeah. Now, right. So. First Airborne Division, they have a very, very good landing on the first day, and they basically recover most of their kit, like in one piece, straight away. Sixth Airborne Division on D-Day lose half of their radios on landing. And you don't hear them complaining about the radios.
Moaning on about
and it's literally,
dodgy
it's literally
radio.
It's like that, you know, they come in with 123 or something and 60 of them are
and
lost.
And you know this now because you can look at all these war diaries and go cross-reference.
Yeah, and I really want
Because it's not, because these war diaries you've got, they're not just for September 1944.
No.
It's the whole thing.
It's the entire thing. So I thought, look at other D-Days for signalling problems. So look at Vastin, look at, that all goes better. And they're relieved immediately, so it's not such a problem. The issue is, you know, when you look at if radio are such a problem at Market Garden, what's the experience? And the experience that they have in Normandy is that they lose half of them. And yes, they are relieved sooner, but they do have a radios problem, but they don't get hung up on it. It's fascinating. And also, the main radio that isn't working is Roy Urquhart's radio, which is why he goes herring off. Most of the rest of the net is working, and the artillery net works the entire time. and the Phantom Net, you know, on the sort of the redundancy they're expecting, where sometimes they can't get through, sometimes they can. There's a business of a there's a business with interference from a lorry, like causing electrical interference in the town. All these complications, but basically, the artillery networks pretty much the entire time. The thing they're really worried about is what they call their DAGs, their batteries, and they're called DAGs because they were made in Dagenham, right? And all of this side of it, and the artillery net pretty much works the entire time. And the PR, the public relations net, back to the War Office works pretty much constantly. And Phantom. So they're able to talk, they're able to talk to London, they're able to talk, they get through to Browning as well and everything. So the radios in general, certainly on the Tuesday, the radios in general are working, I think. There might be other people who view some of this differently, but it's just very interesting that the, you know, the divisional headquarters signals logs basically say, at this point, we were talking to 1st Air Landing Brigade, 4th Para Brigade, 11 Para, the South Staffs, you know, and everyone they need to be speaking to, but basically not the bridge. The bridge is the one person they can't really talk to properly. But the artillery net, the foo at the bridge, is able to talk to the air landing battery around the church pretty satisfactorily. And in fact, calls in a shoot that...
Does the whole kind of battery, you know, the whole radio's not working thing, when is that supposed to be kicking in at that point?
Well, no, the basic problem is on day one, Urquhart's rover set doesn't work.
It's only Urquhart, it's not the rest
only
of it.
Really,
because the way you, in the sort of popular narrative, it's the radios don't really work, no one can communicate with one another, it's all a kind of complete
show. They don't really work within the fact that they don't really work anyway, right? So this is sort of part of the point, is those sets, depending on how practiced you are with them as well, have degrees of reliability, right? And the airborne stuff seems to actually be working with kind, as far as I can tell, and I'm, you know, I defer to someone who knows more about this than me entirely happily. But the sniffing around I'm doing, it just looks like they're kind of working within the expected parameters of the set, and especially moving them around a lot and all this sort of thing. But there's a
huge amount of sort of very fine tuning twiddling. I remember when I was doing all the Sherwood Ranger stuff, the problem of sort of netting up every day. You know, it wasn't just a kind of like switch it to
from
dial
A to
two.
B.
I mean, you've got to kind of...
Well, but it's chiefly his rover set on his Jeep doesn't work. Not, you know, in the sort of first 3-4 hours of the operation. And that's why he goes off to find brigade headquarters and ends up hanging around with Fitch, you know, and cramping his style. Kind of the rest of the net gets up and running. And certainly on the Tuesday, the day I'm looking at, it's all working pretty well. Although there's one juncture in the battle where Colonel Lee in 11 Power has given orders, to redirect what he's doing in the town. But the interference is so bad on the set, he can't be sure what they actually are.
You know, for such a well-trod story, you know, it's sort of like D-Day, isn't it? And sort of trying to come up with something fresh. But it sounds to me like you're getting a huge amount of fresh perspectives and material on all this.
But the interesting thing is what I'm finding is all the stuff we've said, you could condense to the radios are unreliable and they're causing a problem. When are they doing that? To what extent?
Yes. And how much is that responsible for the problems they find themselves?
But when we talked about Fibber last week before last, that's causing much more of a problem, the fact that you can't radio anybody. Whole infantry companies are in four houses, but four houses separated, you know, I think it's the terrain, although there's a, you know, the houses interfere with the radios and the fact that Arnhem has hills and stuff, which they've not expected.
Yeah.
But these are hillier than you think. But these are sort of everything's intersecting and overlapping, and all the problems are overlapping on one another. You know, and you do get the feeling if it had gone well, no one would be talking about the radios. In the same way that on D-Day, the intelligence that 6th Airborne has about possibility of armor being present isn't very good. That they don't have very good intelligence on what's going to be there. But because they win, no one talks about how the intelligence is crap.
Yeah, that is the key, isn't it?
Which is the key, I think, you know. Because
when things go wrong, everyone goes, okay, finger point, you know.
Look for the problems. Look for what the issues are. And I think, you know, Urquhart, in his account, says, when I landed, I was struck by the topography. And you're like, oh, right, okay, now you're struck by the topography. We can't wang on about this forever. You wanted to talk about a Russia party.
Yeah. So it's not a Russian tank. It's not a Russian camp. It's Russian camp, which is R-U-S-H-E-N. Do you remember we talked to Simon Parkin about the Isle of Man and stuff. So this is so I'm literally a day away from finishing this novel that I've been doing for the last few weeks.
Happy ending?
Yeah, obviously.
Oh, great.
Yeah,
thank you for that.
Yeah, no, it's all fine. yes, a girl. The whole premise behind it is it's a family saga set on a farm, but it's three generations, and you follow the points of view of one character at a time, but lots of different characters. And one of the characters is married to one of the sons and has lived in Britain for 20 years, but she's German. And I think we put that extra out on Patreon at one point. So obviously because her family back in Bavaria are her father and her brother are Nazi members.
Yep.
Party members and have been in communication since the start of the war. Yep. She is categorized B rather than a C, even though she's married to an Englishman and has three kids that she's brought up in England. And because she's a category B, when they start collaring the lot, she's one of the people that gets collars, obviously.
Yeah.
This is a bit of a spoiler for anyone who's itching to read Alverston, it has to be said. But anyway, so what happens? You know, so they get, you know, she gets picked up like all the others, and they basically all get interned. And they have quite a horrible time of it. You know, a lot of the women get put in Holloway Prison, for example, for a bit, while they're trying to work out where they're going to put them. And they put them in the Isle of Man. But at the southern end of the Isle of Man is a little tiny little peninsula, which is the parish of Rushen.
Right.
As in Rushen. And there's two villages. There's Port Erin, Erin, and there's St. Mary. And they're on either side of this little peninsula, which is, you know, literally, you know, half a mile wide, you know, mile wide or something, mile and a half wide, something like that. And so what the British do is they put wire across the peninsula north of these two villages, and they turn the village into Russian camp.
What?
And all the internees and their women and, you know, sometimes their children are interned in boarding houses and anyone who wants to put them up and earn a guinea a week.
What?
Yes, it's just the most mad thing. I mean, I've been doing exactly the same thing. So it was much more stringent in the men's camp, and it was pretty slack in the women's camp. So you lived on the bottom of. I mean, if you look at Google Earth and you look at Port Erin, for example, you'll see that there is this little peninsula.
Yep.
And there it is, and basically. It's absolutely extraordinary. So the wire runs across the north, now where there's a golf club.
Yeah.
Over to just north of Gansey.
Yeah. And how many people are in there?
Well, to start off with, not that many. And so I don't know. I haven't got final figures. But anyway, they're all hundreds to start off with, and then thousands, I suppose.
Wow.
And they're all housed in there. My heroine gets put in in a house with a lady called Elsie, who's a widower. And she lives in Shore Road, which exists, and it's right on the bay, and they can do what they like, as long as they don't cross the wire. They go on walks every day, they go in clubs, they kind of hang out, they kind of chat. Elsie has her kind of, you know, times which she does her meals, and, you know, they do high tea, and they drink lots of sugary tea all day long, and you know, have pilchards on toast for tea and stuff. But basically, they can do what they like, and everything's absolutely fine. And she and my heroine, Karin, is put together with Anna Hartman, who is Viennese and who is a musician, but has fled after the Anschluss.
Yeah.
And has got to England and doesn't know where her parents are. Her brother's managed to get to America.
Yeah.
But she's on her own. She doesn't look remotely Jewish. She's not a practicing Jew, but she's Jewish.
Yeah.
And this really, really happened. Another internee turns up and gets put in the same house. And she is an absolute rabid Nazi.
Oh my God.
So I've had quite a lot of, and this happened, you know, and you'd have occasions where you would have Jews and Nazis having to share beds together and stuff in these boarding houses and stuff.
Jesus Christ.
I haven't done that, but how would that play out? I mean, it's quite an intriguing thought, isn't it? What would have happened if you had ended up with three Germans with an English housekeeper?
I mean, there's a black comedy. There's a sitcom in that. I mean,
well, it's been very hard not to kind of turn it into that, to be honest. But I thought, I was just thinking about it, and I was thinking about it. Okay, you're all together. How would that play out? I mean, because the Nazi couldn't just sort of keep doing dew baiting all day long. I mean, it would get it would get boring, wouldn't it? I mean, you know.
Well, I don't know. I think if you're a Nazi, it probably might keep you going all day long. I mean, it's extraordinary.
They have this huge argument about kind of, you know, because she sort of goes, well, you know, it's a burden of our generation that we've got to kind of, you know,
that stuff,
get,
yeah,
all that kind of stuff. She says, you know, it's very unfortunate that we've got to get rid of all the Jews, but the Jews have to go somewhere else. They can't be there because they're not, you know, not pure bloods, and you know, they're not Aryan, yeah, and blah blah blah. And Anna, who's a Jew, just goes, that is just so ridiculous. I mean, this is not my fault I'm a Jew. I didn't choose to be. I'm not practicing. I mean, you know, you're a Christian because you were born a Christian, but you might have been born a Jew. And you know, what Lainey, the Nazi, is not appreciating is that it is just religion. It's not racial. She tries to, Anna, the Jew, tries to smother her with kindness and just push back and push back and push back. And Karin also does the same. And they start to sort of turn her from Nazi positive to Nazi negative.
God almighty.
And they don't really achieve it, but they do, they become sort of friends in a kind of weird sort of way, where they go walks together and they go swimming together and all the rest of it. And they have their sort of difference of opinion, but they kind of, they sort of rub along. And it builds to a big argument where Anna proves that it is not racial, that it is just an accident of religion and birth. And about the whole, because she says, well, in what way are we different? You know, I look the same. You know, we've both got brown hair. We've both got eyes, you know, ears, nose, and all the rest of it. And she goes, well, you know, everyone knows that Jews have got really big noses. And she goes, well, but my nose is clearly smaller than yours. And she goes, that's ridiculous. And so they then have this argument, and they get out a tape measure.
Oh, my God.
And Anna, the Jew, proves that her nose is smaller. And, of course, it just chips away at this absolute certitude that Lainey has of all that kind of nonsense that she's been fed.
Been fed, yeah.
And I think it works. But would that have happened? I mean, to me, that seemed the most logical course of events.
Well, yes, I suppose. If you're living together, it's very strange, isn't it? When was this camp, Russian camp, open from?
30th of May, 1940.
Right, and then closed, what, a couple of years later?
Something like that, yeah.
Wow.
I mean, I'm not really interested after kind of August 1940.
but, of course not. They've left a story, haven't they? Yeah.
But absolutely amazing. And they all had little clubs, and they would knit stuff, and they realized that they, you know, some people had money and some people didn't have money. So what they did was they had a kind of sort of payment in kind, where you worked out what skill set you had, and you would do stuff that you could do, and in exchange for a kind of sort of tokens. A bit too much detail for my novel, but you know, the whole thing's been absolutely fascinating. And trying to recreate that kind of 1940 atmosphere and the kind of Hitler, waiting for Hitler to arrive, and the, you know, the parachutists and the kind of arguments against sort of, you know, it's a kind of, so much of fear is illogical, isn't it? And actually you realise that humans generally are illogical.
Yeah.
You know, we're emotional, aren't we? So we think emotionally and we don't think very logically very often.
No.
And we have logic, which helps us harness our emotions, I suppose.
To be completely tangential about that, I mean, it's no surprise that Nigel Farage was picked to do Trials in the Jungle last night on I'm a Celebrity, to Get Me Out of Here, because people are thinking emotionally. They want to see him suffer.
Yeah. But of course, he'll do really well on that, won't he? Because he'll come across as really charming.
But there's been a load of people going, why is he on this program? It's terrible. So that people can punish him. I mean, come on.
He'll get off incredibly lightly. I bet he's in the last three.
Oh, God.
Anyway, we're on this podcast to talk about I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. So do you know what? They put up the minimum wage of agricultural workers in line with factory workers.
Really?
Yes. In the beginning of June, end of June 1940. This was Dorman Smith, who was the Minister for Agriculture.
Well, this is one of the things, wasn't it? Is that you get you do get wage inflation, and you get, if you're not in the forces, things are, and before the Blitz, really, things are kind of okay, aren't they? Because there's a squeeze on skilled labour, so people's wages go up, and there's a sort of micro consumer boom in the very early part of the war. You know, and you end up with that weird gap where soldiers are removed from society and they're not being paid very well, and everyone who's still going is doing okay, and particularly skilled labour starts getting paid pretty well.
Yeah, so, what happens if you're married and you've got kids and you're not bringing in the income you were before because you're out being soldiering.
Yeah, well, you've got problems, and then of course, and then later in the war, you end up with a consumer shortage and make do amend and all that sort of stuff, because actually the economic effects of a longer war and a distorting that end of things far more than they were expected to. But That's really, really interesting, because after all, this is the other reason you end up with, when you look at the breakdown of who's in the army and they get everyone after the Air Force and the Navy, don't they? Because the technical people get sort of drawn off, that you end up with shopkeepers, basically people who non-essential workforce people end up in the army, which is why you have shopkeepers and novelists and not farmers and not skilled labourers, basically. And then the army start complaining they're just getting people who aren't bright enough.
And there's a whole host of other problems, okay, with farming, because suddenly they're saying, okay, we want to go from, almost producing almost none of our food, all our food all homegrown. Yeah. How do we do that? So you dig up, the grassland, and you plow it all up and you grow more cereals than you ever have before. So 2.1 million acres of land across the country are plowed up that weren't plowed up in 1939. Well, you just think what 2.1 million acres looks like. I mean, I don't know if you've ever been in a 100-acre field, but it's flipping enormous. I mean, it is a big stretch. So 2.1 million acres is a huge, huge number. But of course, 2.1 million acres extra requires a hell of a lot of workforce.
Yeah.
Because harvest time is incredibly labor-intensive.
And mechanization. So, I mean, I think one of the interesting things is how many, very often when we talk about production and industrial production and output and what's being spent on what, you get hung up on tanks and aircraft. But tractors are being churned out in vast amounts.
Well, they are at Dagenham.
Yeah, and threshing machines and stuff, because you've got, like you say, you've got to meet this sudden expansion of...
Yeah, but they're already there. So mechanisation is already there, but most farmers can't afford it.
Yeah.
So what they do is they then create a pool, which is paid for by central government, which is then handed to the counties, and the County War Ag Committee, which is the kind of agricultural committee, which is there to kind of enact the central government's policies, but on a localised level, then has to decide how that machinery is used and who gets it. And of course, it's all very partisan, because the person in North Wiltshire thinks his case is stronger than the people in South Wiltshire. And if you've got this pool, you've still got to move all the machinery around. So these are really tricky decisions. And what they have got combine harvesters by that stage, but very few of them. So mainly what they're using is what's called a reaper binder, or just a binder. So what that does, that's like a cutting arm, which cuts the corn and then gathers it and binds it up into a sheaf, and then spits the sheaf out, and then people go around and put it into stooks, which is where you've got kind of three or four sheaves put together, which you see in the old pictures and all the rest of it. But it's still a hell of a process, and then you have to thresh it, and you can thresh it at different times. You can thresh it in the fields if it's really dry, or you can stack it all up and thresh it in the winter, where the quality's not as good, but it's still okay. So there's this, it's a sort of two-stage process. But the amazing thing about 1940 is that they're worried about loss of manpower, obviously. So they're increasing it with land girls and all the rest of it, and more casual labour. So anyway, so they're really worried about it. So they think, well, okay, we've got to incentivize people to stay on the farm. So the reason we'll do that because even farm workers who are not going to who are too old to join up, are thinking, sod this for a laugh. Why should I be earning 38 shillings a week when I could be earning 50 in a factory? Fair enough. So they raise the minimum wage to 48 shillings. But obviously this has to be funded ultimately by the farmer. But the amazing thing is that the harvest in 1940, so I've also been a bit conflicted by this, because 1940, the whole point was, Goering said that he was going to start Eagle Day on the 13th of August 1940, and he reckoned it was going to take him 3 days, but he'd give himself clear weather, but he'd give himself 4 just to kind of add a little bit of cushion. And he doesn't get those 4 clear days of clear weather across the whole swathe of southern England until the end of September 1940. But actually, the summer of 1940 is really good. It's just it does rain at a certain point, and there's low cloud and stuff, and there's not actually that much rain. There's a lot of cloud. So I was wrong about that in the past. I've always said, it's quite wet. It wasn't that it was wet. It was cloudy.
Overcast.
So clear weather is clear skies. It's not.
Right.
So it's not actually very wet.
And what does that do for the harvest?
Well, it means that it's the earliest harvest on record. And certainly in Wiltshire, the cut is finishing early mid-August, which means they can get it, you know, it's on my farm, they get it in, it's like the earliest on record. And the yields are really hugely up because of fertilizers and extra manure and all the stuff that the government has been paying for. So the yields go up for up to kind of 42 bushels an acre, which is up from about, you know, it's like 31 or 32 the previous year. So that is substantially different.
What we need to do is take a break right now and talk about the thing we were going to talk about when we come back.
Yeah, it's all interesting stuff, though.
Yeah, that's all fascinating. We'll see you in a moment.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching Stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. I mean, you sent me the the week in 1943.
Well, I know, but having been on Tom and Dominic's podcast, I mean, you know, it's all notes and, yeah, you know, they stick to it and, right, moving quickly on.
But I can hear the pieces of paper being moved around in that podcast and I don't like it.
I know I said this to him as well. I said it's cheating.
What is this almanac? I meant to have a copy of this, I think.
Yeah, you are. Okay, so this is. I mean, obviously, I don't approve of the title at all. World War II, Day by
World
Day.
World War II, yeah.
I mean, what's wrong with Second World War, Day by Day? Witness the 2,175 tumultuous, tragic and triumphant days that shook the world.
Does it start on the 3rd or the 1st of September?
Yeah, 1st.
Right, okay, good. Right.
Yeah. He said, I mean, shuffling his notes. You
know, if you're Chinese... If you're Chinese, there's an argument that it started long before that, but let's not get bogged down in that.
Yeah.
So we've got 1943, and before we get into what's going on, there's a really funny little thing, like a puff piece for the Jeep in these pages. One of the greatest success stories of the war is the ubiquitous Willys Jeep. This robust and versatile four-wheeled runabout first came into service in the U.S. Army in the autumn of 1941, and is now used by every Allied army, even including, thanks to Lend-Lease, the Russians and Chinese.
Well, we know about that, don't we?
We do, yeah, exactly, because there are Jeeps at Stalingrad, yeah. I love this. With its simple engine and transmission, it performs equally well in the steaming jungles of Burma and the snowbound steppes of Russia. Its uses are many: staff car, ambulance, load carrier, to name but a few. An amphibious Jeep for river crossings is now in service. And here we go. The British are about to do something daft. And the British are developing the rotor buggy, or flying Jeep.
Which uses an auto gyro rotor. Yeah. I don't know about you, but I haven't heard any more about that.
Nor have I. A Jeep half-tracker for use in Alaska has also been produced. I mean, That's just someone's bright idea, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, yeah. It's absolutely hilarious.
We'll stick an auto gyre on it. That'll work.
Yeah. Also, but also in this week, birth of the United Nations.
Yes, and that's fascinating, isn't it? The way it's reported in inverted commas, and it will help refugees is the headline. 44 nations. Today signed into being the first United Nations organization. This is the 9th of November, 1943.
Yep. Relief and Rehabilitation Administration.
Yeah, so the UNRRA, there it is, UNRRA, right there. Fascinating, isn't it? And that its function is administering refugees, taking care of them, which is still its function. It's extraordinary, isn't it? But this is the thing I think that gets lost along the way is they did call themselves the United Nations a lot. And you'll see that in newspapers in 44 and 45, won't you? The United Nations do this, United Nations do that, meaning the Allies.
Yes, it's not quite the UN that it becomes, but it's...
No, it's a sort of informal yet formal title, isn't it? It's a peculiar sort of halfway before they actually establish the UN and it mutates into the thing it is now. It's really, really interesting that, isn't it?
I love doing this thing once in a while because I love the meanwhile bit of aspect of it. An anti-French unrest spreads in Lebanon. All day, Beirut's Muslim population has been rioting following the arrest by Free French Senegalese troops of Lebanon's president, prime minister, and the entire cabinet. The arrest and suspension of the constitution followed the effective declaration of independence 3 days ago when Lebanon's parliament adopted Arabic as the sole official language, took control of foreign policy, and deleted from the constitution all reference to the prerogatives and powers of the mandatory state.
And what's interesting is on the 11th of November, on the 9th in Algiers, de Gaulle had become Free French president. These are related because de Gaulle's been sort of trying to reactivate France via the empire, hasn't he? That's been his angle. That, you know, France is bigger than France itself. It has the empire, and you use those resources as a political springboard. So if you've got Lebanon declaring independence, everything, the wheels are coming off that quite quickly. And it's interesting that People go on about the British Imperial War effort and try and explain or condemn through that. Here you have Senegalese, I mean, bizarre, isn't it? Senegalese soldiers enforcing French, not even French, free French rule.
Lebanon and Syria had been Vichy French at the start of the war. And in 1941, the summer of 1941, of course, the free French troops are fighting Vichy French troops in Syria. So the kind of, you know, at the end of obviously what happens in North Africa in May 1943, the whole of the Mediterranean turns over to Free French, which is now not the Free French, it's now the Committee of National Liberation.
But, I mean, part of the issue here is that the Gaullists had offered Syria and Lebanon independence in 1941. I mean, this quote in this same piece, General Georges Catru said, "I come to put an end to the mandatory regime and to proclaim you free and independent." And then when they do declare themselves free,
no, we don't want you to do that.
Yeah, I mean, no, not like that. Thanks, lads. Yeah, no. It's extraordinary, isn't it? And obviously, again, it's this thing that the French do endlessly fight. And it goes on into the 50s, isn't it? They're doing this rear guard against the bits of the empire, and into the 60s, bits of the empire detaching themselves. And it's markedly different from the way the British do it, where in the end, the British go, "All right, we're out of here. Whatever, we're off. Fair enough. We haven't got, but I suppose because public opinion in Britain cools on empire so rapidly, you know, by 44, 45, no one's interested in the idea of empire at all. Whereas in France, because de Gaulle's tried to use empire as part of his leverage and to get the army on board and all that sort of stuff, puts everything necessary in a different light, doesn't it? And 2 days later, I mean, third wave of American landings in the Solomons, Bougainville,
well, Tarawa,
and the Gilberts.
We've been talking about.
Yeah, and Tarawa we talked about with John.
Which will be out on Thursday, I think.
Which is a bloodbath.
Yeah. And of course, it's the end of the first battle of Camino on the Bernhard line in Italy.
That's it. That stuff my dad was sending, the colonel was sending me, of the Oxen Bucks up there going up to help the guards.
Yeah.
Really hardcore.
Haven't I been saying?
Totally. Really, really brutal stuff. And basically, they've got no replacements. And they haven't got, and they're going to help, they're going in to help the guards who are out of people. And the Oxen Bucks are out of people as well. You know, sending light infantry in to help the guardsmen. I mean, it's all a pretty desperate situation. I mean, and the Germans really, really resisting hard. I mean, it's really.
Oh my God! I mean, I remember going up onto Monte Camino, and it's just you just it's a bit like Simicro. You just can't believe that they're trying to attack. This is just, there's so little cover. You know, the cover there is sort of, you know, it's a rock, a big rock that you can hide behind. But which is, so you can sort of see how you can sort of defend it, but attacking across it.
Yeah. And at the same time, I mean, there's a lot happening. And also, I don't know, I'm starting to review, I mean, when we talk about Italy, I start to review my opinion that, you know, that, because I've said summer of 1943, if you're the Germans, you're like, well, it's over, isn't it? But if you can hold the Allies up like this in Italy, it's not over, isn't it? There's plenty to keep going on, isn't there?
Well, that's why Jörg Zellner is continuing to fight with the 44th Hocken Deutschmeister. He's saying, what can I do? You know, I've got the, you know, Allied bombers coming over and hitting my hometown of Regensburg. You know, what am I supposed to do? Give up? You know, I've got to protect my family.
And on the subject of bombing campaigns, this is when the Battle of Berlin starts.
Yes,
as well,
it is. Yeah,
on the 19th of November, and there's a cold statement from Arthur Harris.
Yes,
we can wreck Berlin from end to end. It will cost between 400 and 500 aircraft. It will cost Germany the war. I mean, how many people's that? How many crews is that? It's calculus. It's right there laid out.
3,500 per men, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not. We will hope to not lose 400 to 500 aircraft. It will cost. His calculus is laid bare, I think, is really interesting.
Yeah, but I mean, but he would argue how many casualties does the Fifth Army have between September and December 1943? Yeah.
Well, on Tarawa, I mean, we're looking at, what is it? What was it? Is it 2,000 Americans or something?
Yeah, something like that.
For a square mile of beach?
Yeah. So you can understand his kind of sort of very odd logic, but yeah.
But you're trying to do it in winter, and you just talked about clear weather in the summer of 1940. You know, November over Berlin, it's bad weather nonstop, isn't it? You've got to find the place. It's that much further, and they've got pathfinders going and all that sort of stuff. But it's still really a tall order, isn't it? It's really, really hard.
Changing situation in France, of course.
Yeah.
You know, because from November 1942 onwards, it's been completely occupied. And on the 14th of November, Marshal Pétain, having tried and failed to reintroduce a measure of legitimacy and thus free France and himself from the head of the government, Pierre Laval, and his collaborationist clique, is now virtually a German prisoner. Pétain planned to say in a speech that he represented legitimate authority in France and that on his death, power would revert to the National Assembly. However, the contents of the speech were communicated to Hitler, who ordered Pétain not to give it. Instead, the Germans plan to launch a campaign of repression and terror against the resistance, exploiting what is left of Marshal Pétain's reputation.
I mean, it's the idea that I'm going to do this speech. Oh, you can't. Oh, well, that's the end of that then. I mean,
yeah,
he wrote, but, and then, you know, he tried to do a deal with the devil, didn't he? And how else was it going to turn out?
Yeah, exactly. End of the month, you've got the Sextant Conference in Cairo, which is fascinating, actually, because Roosevelt invites Chiang Kai-shek. And Lady Chiang Kai-shek.
Lady Chiang Kai-shek, who everyone thinks
ogles over and thinks is frightfully glamorous and gorgeous.
Glamorous, isn't she?
And everyone wants a glimpse of her. No one's interested in Chiang. They want Mrs. Chiang. And this is Roosevelt's attempt to kind of put China first and foremost. And it doesn't really work. Because straight after this is Tehran, where they go to see Stalin.
See Stalin, yeah.
And Stalin is rather sort of dismissive of that. It's fascinating. So you can get the minutes of all online now. You can get the minutes of all of these conferences. And they're so interesting to read them all. Because, I mean, I don't know. I mean, do you have any idea how these conferences work and, you know, what happens and all the rest of it? I mean,
it's the staffs all meet, isn't it? And then the chiefs all sit around and rubber stamp stuff, isn't it? Or
yeah. So what tends to happen is they all gather, sort of drinks party on the lawn. Everyone says, isn't it splendid that we're all here? And then the following day, they have the opening meeting to which Churchill and Roosevelt are present. And then the rest of it, they're not really until the end. And that what they're having, what Churchill and Roosevelt are doing, are having kind of breakout meetings with individuals, while the combined chiefs of staff get on with the kind of the main meat of the horse trading. Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. You read the minutes, and what is really interesting is They're nothing like as heated as you would imagine.
Well, which is why when there is disagreement and heated discussion, that gets focused on, isn't it? Because it's interesting. If they're all getting along, it's boring, isn't it?
Yeah, if you're, I suppose. Yeah, it's fascinating.
You can't write an Allies at War book if everyone's getting along, can you? I mean,
Allies are really getting along. Yeah,
You're done for, aren't you?
Yeah, I suppose so.
That's what you're after.
I suppose so. But it's fascinating.
But the thing is, though, is this Roosevelt? Because after all, Roosevelt at Casablanca bounces everyone into unconditional surrender, doesn't he? Like, just pitches it out of nowhere, and no one sees that coming. And he's trying. Do you think that with China, he's trying to do that again? He's trying to create some political initiative, and it doesn't always work, does it? Because the British are completely caught out by unconditional surrender. Especially as the Americans have been trying some, you know, conditional stuff with Vichy France. Anyway, it's like it's a very odd tangent. Where it comes from with Roosevelt, why he suddenly arrives at that, catches everyone out. But the fact that is that what he's trying to do with China, do you think? And then, you know, you run into Stalin, who's not interested.
Well, he's also running into the British, who are not interested. And you know, there's this whole narrative, which is, after Casablanca, the Americans are determined never to be caught out again by the British and never going to do what the British wanted. And yet they end up in Italy. And yet they're kind of backing X, Y, and Z. I mean, you know, it's not true. I mean, Britain loses influence and never has, dominates in the same way that it does it at Casablanca, but it's not the case. And you know, the British have quite a lot of pushback on China, which they think is a complete waste of time. At the Sextant Conference, there's lots of chat about China and the Pacific and Southeast Asia and all the rest of it and what they're going to do. There's lots of reinforcement of Operation Overlord, but there's also this sort of big thing: what are we going to do with Italy? Because Italy's taking longer. You know, we might not get to Roman time. So this is where they first start talking about kind of, okay, well, let's get some extra landing craft so you can do an outflanking operation, which becomes Operation Shingle, which becomes, you know, sort of course, the Anzio landings in third week of January, 1944. You know, all that's going on as well. And also the Churchill is really pushing hard for kind of operations in the Eastern Mediterranean, trying to get Turkey in. He's obsessed with Turkey. He's always been obsessed with Turkey. And that hasn't changed since Gallipoli.
Yeah.
He's still trying to get Turkey in.
That's an imperial mindset, isn't it? They're one of the imperial chess pieces on the board, aren't they? The Turks still, even though they are interesting in this almanac. So 3 days before Pétain tries to speak up against the Germans, there's a commemoration of the armistice on the 11th of November. Pétain has banned that because people are trying to commemorate the First World War. So he's got problems of his own, isn't he?
Big time.
Keeping the lid on in France.
Yeah.
So obviously, 3 days later, he tries to sort of flex his muscles independently, and the Germans stop him. I mean, who do we know that we could get on to talk about Vichy France? Because
Matthew Cobb is brilliant.
Well, why don't we do that?
We get
at some
Douglas
point?
Porch, of course.
Yeah, that book's amazing.
Well, let's get him on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, he'd be good.
Okay. All right. Well, I think there we go. That's what's going on roughly now in 1943. It's not a bad little canter, Jim.
No, it's pretty good, really.
Through that. Yeah.
You know, some rabbit holes, but
excellent.
That's okay.
Yeah, standard. Anyway, I think that's it for this week. We will see you very, very, very soon. But don't forget, tickets are on sale for We Have Ways Fest, 18th, 21st July, 2024. Bring your invasion stripes. We will see you there. Thanks for listening. I think.
Oh, Mike Nyberg, of course, is a Vichy expert as well.
Yeah, he's brilliant on it. Yeah. Well, anyway, we'll get around to it at some point. Yeah. And on Thursday, is it us talking to John about
Tarawa?
Tarawa. Yeah.
Tarawa.
Okay. Brilliant. Debate as to how to pronounce it. Yeah. We will see you soon. Thanks very much for listening. Cheerio. Goodbye.
Cheerio.